We are singing our new gathering song this morning, so I just want to let you know which number it is. It's number 188. Come, come, whoever you are. Welcome. Good morning. My name is Katie Kingery Page. I'll be your convener today. I welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. You're welcome here no matter who you love, no matter how you define yourself, and whatever burdens you carry. We are grateful you are here. This Sunday, we begin our theme for December. What does it mean to be a community of presence? As we begin our Sunday service, I'd like to ask you to take a moment to look at the announcements within the order of service, and I'd like to call a couple of things to your attention. After the service today, immediately after, well, get a cup of coffee and then come back, but pretty closely after, we'll have a feedback circle on Sunday services. Anyone is welcome to join that. There will be members of the Sunday Services Committee, as well as Reverend Johnstone, there at the feedback circle to listen and record your feedback. We really want to hear how things are working for you. What are you enjoying? What are you not enjoying? What would you like to stay different? And what do you hope does not change? That's right after service today. I'd also like to make sure you're aware that a week from today, Sunday, December 11th, we have our annual holiday craft and bake sale. And there's a couple things I'd like to say about that. One is that if you haven't ever contributed to the craft and bake sale yourself, please know that all contributions of baked goods and crafts are welcome. They do not have to be by professional crafters. All kinds of things are welcome. We have a wonderful eclectic sale. Also, please bring your checks, cash, or credit cards, because we take all of those now. That's right after service next Sunday, December 11th. And then one more announcement that I want to be sure to mention. We are having a congregational meeting two Sundays from now after the service, December 18th. That meeting is to discuss and vote upon a resolution regarding ending the use of Native American mascots in our community schools. And please, in your order of service, there's more information on that. Feel free to read about it in advance. Okay. As we start our Sunday service every week, we have a tradition of lighting the chalice, which is a symbol for us, that this is a safe haven as a community. Before I light the chalice, I'd like to read For This 1 Hour by Paul Stephen Dodonoff. For this 1 hour, spirit of life, we let go. For this 1 hour, may we let go of our anxieties, our fears, our anger, our self-doubts, our regrets, our petty grievances, and our distractions, if only for this 1 hour. Let the flame of this chalice burn them from our hearts and minds and light our way to peace, serenity, and the presence of this moment for this 1 hour. And I'd like to invite now Michelle Hill and Rowan and Julia to come forward and light the chalice. Did I get their names right? Good, good, okay.
My colleague, K. Karen Van Fosen, who's minister of the UU congregation in Bismarck, North Dakota, has written these words. Chief Arville Looking Horse, keeper of the white buffalo calf pipe bundle, has called upon each of us to join him at Standing Rock on Sunday, December the 4th, for an interfaith day of prayer. In solidarity with Indigenous people and mutual love for the water, it is my hope that you and your communities of faith participate in this history-making day. As those who have visited know, the nonviolent water protector movement at Standing Rock is deeply rooted in prayer. Each day I spend at Ocheti Sakawan Camp, I feel myself challenged and inspired to live a more prayerful and faithful life. We awake with prayers, dine with prayers, go to rest with prayers, and pray continuously throughout each day. The camps at Standing Rock are based on the conviction that prayer, especially collective prayers, can protect our living water. Your prayers and your presence mean the world. Again, those were the words of Karen Van Fosen from the UU congregation in Bismarck, North Dakota. In this congregation, we differ in how we view prayer. We're invited, though, by Indigenous people to participate. And whether or not you feel able to pray, I invite all of us to take a few moments to turn our hearts to those standing this day at Standing Rock in the spirit of prayer. And in keeping with that spirit, I invite you to join me in reading responsively number 518 in the back of your hymnal. The words of prayer here are adapted from the Ojibwe people, one of the more than 400 tribes supporting the water protectors at Standing Rock. So please read the italics in response to the words that I read. And following the reading, I invite us to spend just a moment in silent prayer, meditation, contemplation, or sending energy, keeping in mind those gathered at Standing Rock. Grandfather, look at our brokenness. We know that we are the ones who are divided.
And we are the ones who must come back together to walk in the sacred way.
Grandfather, Sacred One, teach us love, compassion, and honor.
That we may heal the river and heal each other.
So may it be.
Please join us in singing "Tis a Gift to Be Simple," number 16. Rise and sing as you're able. In and grab a seat. A beloved community not only nurtures one another's spiritual and intellectual growth, we also embrace each other's humanity by sharing our highest joys and the heavy burdens of our hearts. Please raise your hand if you have a joy or concern to share today. The microphone will be brought to you.
My joy is that, I'm Christopher Renner, is that on Friday night I went to that Making Change gathering that we received an email about. Y'all should have been there. There was about 60 to 80 people, the vast majority I've never seen before in my life, who were all speaking out against Trump and wanting to find a town based where diversity is accepted, where people don't have to be afraid because of the color of their skin, where there's affordable housing, where there's a decent public transportation system. The follow-up meeting is going to be on January 23rd. I highly recommend that we make an effort to be there because the energy was phenomenal, just phenomenal.
Are there any other joys or concerns among us?
Hi, Austin Roberts. Carrie and I have a joy in that we had our second sonogram, and we now know that we are going to be having a little boy.
Thank you. Thank you. The lovely young woman next to me last Friday celebrated for the 35th time her 39th birthday.
I have a joy to share. I had the joy of hearing one of our own UU youth speak about something that she cared deeply about, Ms. Lily Colburn. I heard her speak Wednesday night at the Board of Education meeting. She did a wonderful job, and I'm so proud of you, Lily. By sharing, may our joys multiply, and may our burdens feel lighter on the strength of our shared shoulders. We now have a very special musical moment today. I am thrilled to be able to announce it. Laudamus Tay by Terry Sinclair will be the piece played, featuring Helen Ferguson Mayfield on flute and four UUFM singers, Clara Ferguson Mayfield, Molly McGoy, Pat Embers, and Marissa Larson, with accompaniment by Renee Reisner. I'd like to note for everyone here listening that we do have a translation from the Latin, provided within the order of service, if you'd like to read along. Do we need just a moment to set up? Okay, great. Come forward.
Oh,
I'll invite the children to come join me up front. So I think maybe the last time I was here telling a story, it was just before a holiday, Thanksgiving. So now we're getting ready for another holiday. Yule, yeah, yeah. Some people might be getting ready for Christmas. And in some churches, there's a special name for the time when people are getting ready for Christmas. Anybody know what that is? Does anybody know what that is?
Advent.
Advent is the time that in some congregations, they are thinking about Christmas and thinking about getting ready for it. So what are you waiting for? What are you getting ready for? Christmas? Anything in particular? Going on a trip? Yeah, trips. That's fun. That's good.
You want us to say presents.
There, presents. So today we're talking about two kinds of things that sound pretty much the same. Presents and presents. Okay, so you know what this is, right? Presents, gifts. So what's this? Presents. What does that mean? Just time being. Just time being there. That's good. But what we're going to have a story about is actually the other kind, sort of, but maybe this is really a story about, I don't know, it's about one of them, or maybe both of them. Let's see. This is the smallest gift of Christmas. Roland was eager for Christmas Day. He raced downstairs to see what was waiting for him. Have you ever done that?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That there are some rules there. All right. But when he saw his present, he was not impressed. It was the smallest gift he had ever seen. Had he waited the whole year for this tiny gift? Roland closed his eyes and hoped and wished as hard as he could for a bigger gift. And when he opened his eyes, there was a bigger gift. "You call that big?" Roland asked. He had been wishing for something much bigger. He closed his eyes and wished a little harder. "Ha! That isn't much bigger than me," Roland said, "and I'm not very big. I want a bigger gift." "Big? That's not even as big as my house. When I say big, I mean big," he yelled. Roland stomped off. Sure, somewhere there was a bigger gift for him. Somewhere. In the distance, he saw a present wedged between two buildings. "Now that," Roland thought, "that's pretty big." Still not big enough. Roland was determined. Where is he going? He's going into space. Oh, my gosh. So he set off to search the universe. He searched and searched, but all he could see was billions of stars. Roland peered into his telescope. He could just make out a tiny dot in the distance. What is that dot?
Earth.
Earth, his home, his family. Now just a speck growing smaller and smaller. Roland realized that he was very, very far from home, and that if he waited a heartbeat longer, that little dot would disappear. Roland never thought he'd want something so small, so badly. He closed his eyes and hoped and wished with all his might for that tiny speck. The smallest gift. And as the rocket headed back toward it, the dot grew bigger and bigger. And as Roland's rocket landed gently, he realized that the smallest speck was his biggest gift. Roland was home. Does that look like a happy Christmas? Merry Christmas. So, you all can go on to your classes.
Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
Our vision as UUFM asks us to be a visible beacon of liberal religious values and a bold model of love. We aspire to a strong, inspiring, and just presence in the Manhattan community. Please give your support to sustain the presence and strengthen the relationships, those we've already established, those that are just beginning, and those that we don't even yet know are needed, between our beloved community and the larger community.
Thank you.
Please rise in body, voice, or both to join us for the hymn Dark of Winter, and it is number 55, not 54. There's an error in our order of service. 55. This morning we have a series of reflections on presence, with a T-S, or presence, with a C-E. And I'm going to kick off those reflections. My reflection around this theme has been a family presence reflection. I've been a mother for about 16 years now, so it's not really news to me that there's no substitute for time with your children. For being present. I've never been one to suppose that buying things for my kids would substitute for time together. It's not that I don't enjoy giving gifts to my children. I sure do. I really enjoy that. And I even have greater joy in just hearing about what they might want. Ruby made her Christmas list this year on a Rockabilly coaster, which is a sure way to get my attention, is to pass it to me. And her Christmas list had two requested gifts. One was a pair of pink go-go boots, and the other is a mini wiener dog. So, unfortunately, we can't take a dachshund into our house right now. She will be disappointed, but I'm going to do my best to find those pink go-go boots. So there's a lot of joy in giving of presents and gifts, and nothing that I say that follows here should take away from that joy. It's just that over the past 3 years or so, I've learned a valuable lesson about presence, about being there. As the pop culture mystic and philosopher Ram Dass very famously wrote, be here now. Be here now. And as a parent, sometimes I find that very hard, to just be here now. And I find this somewhat hard to talk about. I have a family member who has struggled very mightily just to stay attached to life. And there was never any question that I'd be there for her. But what I've had to learn is that being there, it doesn't mean showing up just at the right moment and having the right thing to say. It doesn't mean delivering some little pithy nugget of kindness or solace, or even showing up with the right library book at the right moment that might inspire her. I've come to learn it actually means something else. And for me, just as the most difficult passage of parenting that I had ever experienced began, my father, who'd always been a touchstone for me in my life in difficult times, had died after a long illness. And sometimes during really hard days, I would just long to be able to call him and to ask him for advice. I really wanted to hear his voice. And I wanted to ask him, how did you deal with two wacky teenagers? Because three. I guess he had three to raise. Not just two. But my older brother and I were sure trouble. We have a younger brother who was, he was really the golden child. But we were, trouble. We were sure trouble. So I knew he had been through some things. And I needed someone to ask, how do you coach your children through the dark passages? And what helps a parent stay sane and grounded and maybe even keep a sense of humor? A lot of humor, because I think deep and subtle humor, that's really what can pierce despair. And with time, as I would have those moments of grieving, of missing my dad and his smartness, I remembered that even though he was gone, he'd actually already shown me the way. He'd shown me how to be present. When I was a kid, I spent a lot of time with him. Various factors, I guess to sum it up, as underpaid employees in different various enterprises, my parents never had adequate childcare. So there were really two choices. They could leave us home alone, and there was plenty of that, or they could take us with them. And as a result, we spent a lot of time tagging along everywhere in every part of their lives. When I was a small kid, some of my most vivid memories are of walking with my father across the campus where he was a graduate student, and my short little legs had to run to keep up with him. That's my memory, is of being like, Daddy, wait, running after him. But there were also, in those days, there were a lot of moments of pause where we were just together. Maybe it was at the campus museums or in a cafeteria somewhere or in a lobby of a building. And we spent time just being in each other's presence. For most of my childhood, my dad was working as a writer, so we spent long days and nights alone at home. He was always tapping away in his study. And that was a place that we could enter to speak to him, but we knew better than to disturb anything in these clouds of cigarette smoke. Carefully arranged shelves of books, postcards from other writers, photos, and what seemed to me at the time like this careful array of creative talismans. By the time we were school age, when we returned home every day, our dad was itching to get out of the house. He needed a break from his solitude, and we were the lucky recipients of his need for social contact. My dad's name was Tom, and somehow when we started calling him that as toddlers, my older brother and I, he never corrected us. So we called him Tom all through our baby childhood, and it was a kind of funny habit that I kept up until he was in his very last years and I started to call him Dad. As a teenager, I remember that Tom would gladly take me to the laundromat to wash my clothes. And he would sit for hours on those hard plastic chairs with me, you know, those orange and yellow and green chairs. He would sit with me for hours and discuss anything we wanted. He would tell me stories. He would listen to my stories. We did a lot of people watching. And we didn't talk about the people we were watching, but sometimes just with a little sideways glance or the way he held his hands, I understood what he was thinking as we watched all these various family dramas unfolding in the laundromat. And he loved road trips. We spent hours talking in the cab of his truck or riding in silence with the radio set to jazz. He was a very well-read person and actually also surprisingly sensitive and empathetic to a teenage girl that I was. So he did always seem to know what to say. But that wasn't his secret. I think his secret was being there. His secret for teenage parenting was boring, slow time together. And that's what I needed to remember in my own struggles as a parent. I think for working parents, and particularly for working mothers, that the idea of work-life balance, it is an elusive unicorn in the forest. I've never felt it was a real thing. It's an unattainable goal. So as a result of realizing that I needed to have boring, slow times with my teenager, I've had to pull back from some of my communities in the community. I can't give as much. I can't be at meetings every night in addition to my own work, which I need to survive. My family needs to survive, but also which brings me a lot of meaning. I need these slow, boring times with my kid. And so I'm trying to make the space to let that happen and to be truly present with them.
Well, good morning. Can everybody hear me? Okay. I'm going to try to keep this to 10 minutes, I promised y'all, and so, good Lord knows I like to talk. So, in my 15 years of university teaching, I have found that audiences tend to be much more receptive and engaged when you talk about concrete, real-life examples as opposed to abstract concepts. So, presence, I mean, these are complicated concepts, and I would like to argue that their importance is more, how do I put it, relative than absolute. And let me tell you two stories. I mean, they're not the most inspiring stories, I'm sorry, but then they are real, and they concern the two most important men in my life, my father and my husband. So let me start with story number one. I was born and raised in India, in Delhi for the most part, and my father was a constant presence in my life for the 24 years I lived there until I moved to the U.S. And he was a man of habit. You could literally set your watch by his activities. At 6:10 sharp, he'd be home from work every day. At 7, he'd start drinking. By 8, he'd start getting abusive. And by 9, he'd start getting violent. And by 10, he'd be in his bed, sound asleep, snoring blissfully. I don't want to share the thoughts I had in my head when I'd see him sleeping soundly after basically torturing me for 2 hours every night. All I can say is, thank you, Lord, I didn't act on those thoughts, or I wouldn't be here today. So, all right, so he was a presence in my life. I mean, like, you know, he never went anywhere. He never went anywhere on work. He never went anywhere for anything. He didn't like to travel. He'd show up every evening. I'd actually be praying as 6 p.m. approached. Like, you know, I'd get more and more nervous, more and more panicky. I'd pray, oh, Lord, can there be an accident? Can you please not let him come home? But the Lord doesn't listen to such prayers, obviously. And so he'd show up by 6:10. And from 6:10 until 10 p.m., every night my life was a living hell. I would describe what he did to me as emotional and psychological rape. And that's pretty much what it was for 24 years. All right, moving on to story number two. This was my husband. Now, my husband was born and raised in Poland, and he was born and raised Catholic. And so he actually struggled with his sexuality in a way that I never did. He wanted to live. He wanted to be a good Catholic boy. He wanted to have a normal family, have children, have a normal life. He just wanted to not be gay. I mean, it's something that I have never experienced, so I cannot, like, you know, comment on it. But let's just say that he tried very, very hard for a long time until he kind of made peace with who he was. And so as part of that trying to be normal, he had a relationship with a woman back in Germany. And he wanted to marry her. He wanted to be a good Catholic father and husband. And the lady told him that they would get married the moment she was pregnant. And so she got pregnant. But then she changed her mind. And she went back to Germany. This happened when he was already in the U.S. He was in Connecticut. She went back to Germany. She had the baby there. Now, he wanted to be present in the life of his daughter. I mean, I hope you all have a chance to meet her one day. She is just the most wonderful person I've met. I mean, she looks like an angel. I mean, blonde hair, blue eyes, just beautiful. And she's just a wonderful person, too. Anyway, so he wanted to be a presence in her life. But he was a poor international student here living on like $10,000 a year. And so he would actually go without food and without heat and went deeply into debt to be able to fly back and forth to Germany to see her at least twice a year. And I would be with him while he was packing to go to Germany. And he would actually go to Target or wherever and buy all these presents for his daughter. Like, you know, age appropriate. Like, you know, this happened over several years. And I'd see him as he was packing. He'd lift every present up to the light, look at it with such anticipation and delight that I'm going to go see my daughter. I'm going to go give her this, and she's going to play with it, and she's going to be happy. And so he'd pack his suitcases full of these presents, and he'd fly to Germany. He'd spend like a precious week with her, and then he had to come back. And talking about presents, because my father, the 24 years I lived with him, he never bought me a single present, because the only thing he ever wanted to spend money on was alcohol. And so I tell you these two stories because they are very contrasting in terms of presence and presence. I was blessed with the presence of my father in my life constantly for 24 long, unbearable years, through the length of which I did not even receive one present from him. On the other hand, my husband's daughter has grown up without the presence of a father in her life because of the tyranny of distance, because he lives here and she lives there. And with every fiber in his being, he wants to be with her. He wants to be there for her, and he cannot. And he tries to make up for it by getting her presence every time he goes there to see her. But then, do those presents really make up for the fact that she has grown up without him in her life? I met her last year and I told her that, I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but honey, you have no idea how unfortunate you are to have not had the presence of this amazing man in your life. That fate conspired to keep you apart from him, even though he could have been the best father in the universe to you. And in comparison, I had a father whom I couldn't wait to get away with. But then the way fate played its role there is that he never went anywhere. He was always there, and he was always this malevolent, extremely destructive presence in my life. So, talking about presence versus presence, it's really strange how it kind of pans out sometimes. And, which is why I say that their importance is relative rather than absolute. Sometimes you might rather have presence with a T than somebody's presence in your life. And on the other hand, all the presence in the world cannot make up for the absence of someone who ought to be in your life. Thank you.
So this morning's topic was kind of inspired by the Jesse Jackson quotation that I think Katie was really kind of illustrating. Your children need your presence more than your presence. So the expression is cute and a clever play on words, and not a bad adage to contemplate in this season when it can be way too easy to get obsessed with presence that we shop for. The homonyms presence and presence actually have a common origin from the Latin presentia, being at hand. And the quality of presence with the C came first. Being at hand works as a definition of that, even in the multiplicity of shades and meanings of the word. Now, the idea of a gift being a present comes out of that idea, because a present is something presented, a gift, yes, but it's a particular kind of gift. It's a gift that does honor or reflects love. And so, not just any gift qualifies as a present. I think the gifts that Deepak was talking about, holding up and thinking about, those qualify as presents. I think the pink go-go boots probably qualify as a present. But the more concrete presents have a whiff then of presence, CE, to them, a touch of being at hand, those things that when you look at it, you say, ah, my mother gave me this. Ah, this friend gave me, that have their presence in it. So we'll hope, as we determine what presence we wish to give and receive, to have that sense of being at hand in those gifts. Being at hand means that you are here. Woody Allen is sometimes cited as saying 80% of success is showing up. showing up, being physically present matters. Showing up for your family matters. Showing up at a school board meeting matters. Showing up for Sunday services matters. Showing up for work matters. Presence in this sense matters because your priorities are determined not by what you claim as priorities, but by what you actually support by being there. And this is a little hard for me because there are so many things I am interested in and want to do. And it's easy for me to consume my time with what I'm interested in and not what I would claim as a priority. Sometimes these distractions get more of my attention than what I think are priorities. Really making myself prioritized by showing up for what most matters is not always easy. And it gets harder. Being there can be physical bodily presence, but that's not always enough, as Deepak illustrated. It can carry a more nuanced meaning. We all know times when we or others around us have been physically there but not really present to us, or we present to others. I can sit next to someone or across from them and be playing on my phone or preoccupied with what I'm going to say in my reflection on Sunday. And I've heard this referred to as being dislocated, which is an apt opposite to being present. When we are dislocated, we do not know where we are. We are psychologically apart from where we physically are. It's getting harder and harder to maintain real presence in this culture, to resist dislocation as the demand for immediacy has increased. We live in a culture that's more and more oriented to the immediate, quick responses to text messages, social media flare-ups, 24-hour news cycle. These assaults do not improve our quality of presence, because we leap from one distraction to another without actually connecting and being present. We become dislocated. Or maybe I'm only talking about my own struggles. Anybody else feel that way? Okay, good, good. I can go on Facebook and scroll through my news feed, jumping from the meal my cousin ate last night to the latest appointments by the president-elect, to deaths and births and birthdays, the serious and the trivial, the aggrieved and celebrating, all mingled together chaotically. And how can I be present to any of it? My focus is diluted. I'm disconnected from it all. I am dislocated. What's more, the intensity of this moment in history has exacerbated the challenge. I'm hearing ministerial colleagues complain that the people in their congregation are bouncing between hysteria and numbness. Most of us have felt drawn to those extremes. Many of us do not understand what is happening in our world. And when we do not understand, we are easily frightened. When we witness the undermining of our values, our blood pressure rises, and hysteria is not far behind. It can seem that the only escape from the wild emotions is to numb ourselves, either psychologically protecting ourselves by pulling back or indulging in addictive behavior. Somewhere, somehow, there must be recourse. There has to be a way to engage without hysteria or numbness. From a theological perspective, we have become disconnected from that which grounds us and gives us direction, priorities, and depth. We will only survive these times if we can find a way to be fully present in a thoughtful and compassionate manner, consistent with our values, without being reactive. Father Richard Rohr, a contemporary mystic and activist, has said, "All spiritual disciplines have one purpose, to get rid of illusions so that we can be present. These disciplines exist so that we can see what is, see who we are, and see what is happening. Those spiritual disciplines can be quite diverse. One I have found helpful is relationship, being fully present in relationship. That was part of what Katie was talking about. The Jewish theologian Martin Buber spoke about these qualities of relationship in his classic book, I and Thou. Some translations use the word you, but I like using thou because it demands additional thought. You is routine every day. Thou invites a closer examination, and historically, thou was used as a familiar pronoun with family, with children. Buber's basic contention is that we often relate with other people not as a thou, but as an it. Something that doesn't matter. That is, we do not relate directly with them, opening ourselves to them, being present, but rather as an it. Maybe a means to achieve our goals, or maybe something standing in the way of our goals. And that's what we do when we listen without really listening, instead composing our next rejoinder. In short, we use those its, those actual people. We use them rather than relating with them. And here is Buber's explanation as translated by Walter Kaufman, except that I changed his you to thou and have altered some gender-based pronouns. When I confront a human being as my thou and speak the basic I-thou to him or her, then he is no thing among things, nor does she consist of things. He is no longer he or she, limited by others' he's and she's, a dot in the world grid of space and time, nor a condition that can be experienced and described, a loose bundle of named qualities. Neighborless and seamless, he or she is thou and fills the firmament. Not as if there were nothing but that person, but everything else lives in their light. Even as a melody is not composed of tones, nor a verse of words, nor a statue of lines, one must pull and tear to turn a unity into a multiplicity, so it is with the human being to whom I say, thou. I can abstract from them the color of their hair, or the color of their speech, or the color of their graciousness. I have to do that again and again, but immediately the person is no longer thou. So that's Buber. In short, to view someone as thou, we let a person stand as fully who they are, not just pulling out the particular characteristics, not boiling them down or slotting them into labels, but accepting them fully as human, fully as the wholeness that they really are. And Buber says we can encounter non-human beings as thou also. One of his most famous images is of a relationship with a tree. Here are his words. I contemplate a tree. I can accept it as a picture, a rigid pillar in a flood of light, or splashes of green traversed by the gentleness of blue-silver ground. I can feel it as movement, the flowing veins around the sturdy, striving core, the sucking of the roots, the breathing of the leaves, the infinite commerce with earth and air, and the growing itself in its darkness. I can assign it to a species and observe it as an instance with an eye to its construction and its way of life. I can overcome its uniqueness and form so rigorously that I recognize it only as an expression of the law, those laws according to which a constant opposition of forces is continually adjusted, or those laws according to which the elements mix and separate. I can dissolve it into a number, into a pure relation between numbers, and eternalize it. Throughout all of this, the tree remains my object and has its place and its time span and condition. But it can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into relation, and the tree ceases to be an it. The power of exclusiveness has seized me. This does not require me to forego any of the other modes of contemplation. There is nothing that I must not see in order to see, and there is no knowledge that I must forget. Rather is everything, picture and movement, species and instance, law and number, included and inseparably fused. So I propose that viewing others, human or not, as Buber's vow, is being fully present to them. I further suggest that that is how we escape from the fragmented, immediacy-oriented culture. It's how we stop being dislocated. Instead of skimming the surface of multiple sources and distractions, we give ourselves over to presence, to who and what we are with in the moment. Give ourselves over. That sounds risky. I may miss something. I may be thrown off from what I am pursuing and get drawn into someone else's agenda. I may lose control. I may suffer in ways I can't even predict. If I withhold my presence, then I protect myself. I am safe. Or so we think. That safety is an illusion. By withholding presence, we may avoid the interference of some feelings, compassion, for example, and even some sorts of distress that others are feeling. Instead, though, when we pull it all in, we feed anxiety, and the more we disconnect from what and who is around us, the more we disconnect with ourselves. The activist playwright Eve Ensler, best known for her vagina monologues, also wrote a memoir about having cancer and how it helped her reclaim her presence in her own body. Part of that recovery reminds me of the Buber contemplation, because from her hospital room, she saw a tree. And here's what she wrote. I was too weak to think or write or call or even watch a movie. All I could do was stare at the tree, which was the only thing in my view. At first, it annoyed me, and I thought I would go mad from boredom. But after the first days and many hours, I began to see the tree. On Tuesday, I meditated on bark. On Friday, the green leaves shimmering in late afternoon light. For hours, I lost myself, my body, my being dissolving into tree. I had believed that life itself was inconsequential unless it led to something, unless the tree would be wood, would be house, would be table. What value was there to tree? So to actually lie in my hospital bed and see tree, enter the tree, to find the green life inherent in tree, this was the awakening. Each morning I opened my eyes, I could not wait to focus on tree. I would let the tree take me. Each day it was different, based on the light or wind or rain. The tree was a tonic and a cure, a guru and a teaching. There was the tree, my tree. Not that I owned it. I had no desire for that. But it had come to be my friend. my point of connection and meditation, my new reason to live. I was not writing or producing or on the phone or making anything happen. I was not contributing much more than my appreciation of tree, my love of green, my commitment to trunk and bark, my celebration of branch, my insane delight over the gentle white blossoms that were beginning to flower everywhere. So the tree became for Ensler a vow she was fully present to. The tree would not be wood or house or table. She was simply engaging with the tree, relating to the tree, being present with the tree as it was, not as a useful object, not as an it. Remember what Richard Rohr said, all spiritual disciplines have one purpose, to get rid of illusions so we can be present. Eve Ensler became present with the tree, through the tree. We have no time now for illusions. We need to be present. Now, Martin Buber takes the I-thou relationship a little further. This may be a stretch for some of you, but we'll go there, okay? If you put a dash or a hyphen between the I and the thou, Buber calls that punctuation mark the presence of God. Whenever we encounter another as thou, Buber says we are encountering God. I quote him once more, extended, the lines of relationship intersect in the eternal thou. Every single thou is a glimpse of that. People have addressed their eternal thou by many names. When they sang of what they had thus named, they still meant thou. The first myths were hymns of praise. Then the names entered into it language. People felt impelled more and more to think of and to talk about their eternal thou as an it. But all names of God remain hallowed because they have been used not only to speak of God, but to speak to God. Now, some would deny any legitimate use of the word God because it has been misused so much. Certainly, it is the most burdened of human words. Precisely for that reason, it is the most imperishable and unavoidable, for whoever pronounces the word God and really means thou addresses, no matter what their delusion, the true thou of their life that cannot be restricted by any other and to whom they stand in a relationship that includes all others. And so that brings us back around to presence. Another use of the word presence. We speak of a presence as an invisible, ill-defined, perhaps even supernatural influence. We speak of it poetically more than literally, as we speak of the dark of winter as a thou, something that is more than winter, something that links us to the eternal, transcending time and space, and connects with us personally, profoundly, even as we remain here connected with the presence present to it. Okay, that sounds really confusing. When we try to put words to this aspect of our lives, words inevitably fail. In this season of Advent, when many around us wait for the birth of God or the Son of God, I'm not waiting in the sense that they are, yet I understand the longing to find a presence that reminds me of some kind of connection that helps me know who I am, why I am, and how I should move forward. That longing comes particularly in these challenging days. My hope for myself and for all of you is that even as we shop for the presence, those true gifts from ourselves, honoring others whom we love, we find a way to be present to those around us, to those with whom we share this congregation, to those whom we explicitly love, and to this tattered, needy world. My hope is also that you find others present to and with you, and that together we embody a presence that transforms this world into the reality we wish to come into being. My hope, my wish, my prayer for us all. I close with words from John O'Donohue. When the light around lessens and your thoughts darken until your body feels fear turn cold as a stone inside, when you find yourself bereft or any belief in yourself and all you unknowingly leaned on has fallen, when one voice commands your whole heart and it is raven dark, steady yourself and see that it is your own thinking that darkens your world. Search and you will find a diamond thought of light. Know that you are not alone and that this darkness has purpose. Gradually it will school your eyes to find the one gift your life requires hidden within this night corner. Invoke the learning of every suffering you have suffered. Close your eyes. Gather all the kindling about your heart to create one spark that is all you need to nourish the flame that will cleanse the dark of its weight of festered fear. A new confidence will come alive to urge you toward higher ground where your imagination will learn to engage difficulty as its most rewarding threshold. And with that, our closing hymn is number 6, Just As Long As I Have Breath. Kathleen McTeague, may the light around us guide our footsteps and hold us fast to the best and most righteous we seek. May the darkness around us nurture our dreams and give us rest so that we may give ourselves to the work of the world. Let us seek to remember the wholeness of our lives, the weaving of light and shadow in this great and astonishing dance in which we move.